A much-loved movie is now going on stage. The low-budget Irish independent film Once came out in 2007. It won an Oscar and a devoted following. The website Rotten Tomatoes, where people rate films, gives it a 97% rating. Now, Once has been adapted as an off-Broadway musical. It gives people a chance to revisit the story of two musicians in Dublin who meet, write songs together, and fall in love. Jeff London reports.
Once, the movie, was kind of the little engine that could. Made on a shoestring in Dublin, it starred songwriters Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova playing thinly veiled versions of themselves. And it was as much about the love of making music as it was about the budding but unfulfilled love between the two central characters.
I don't know you, but I want you all the words fall through me and always fool me, and I can't react.
With a soundtrack filled with attractive contemporary folk music, the film became a cult hit, grossing $20 million worldwide, and this song, Falling Slowly, won the Academy Award for Irglova and Hansard.
This is amazing. What are we doing here? This is mad. We made this film 2 years ago. We shot it on two handy cams. It took us 3 weeks to make. We made it for 100 grand. We never thought we'd ever come into a room like this and be in front of you people. It's been an amazing thing. And thanks for taking this film seriously, all of you. It means a lot to us. Thanks to the Academy. Thanks to all the people who have helped us. They know who they are. We don't need to say them. This is amazing. Make art. Make art. Yeah, thanks.
Now, an entirely different team of collaborators is making art with the songs and story from the film. Director John Tiffany and choreographer Stephen Hoggett, who created Black Watch, an indelible theater piece about a Scottish regiment in Iraq, are helming the show. It's being adapted by award-winning Irish playwright Enda Walsh. Walsh says the challenge was to take a delicate little story about an Irish busker and a Czech immigrant and create something more robust for the stage.
Our sensibilities were always to retain the heart of the piece, but, you know, it needs a language and it needs a more sort of physical narrative to sort of exist on stage, because if you were to place that on stage, it would evaporate. We know that as theatre makers.
What Walsh and his collaborators have done is not only to reinforce plot points and build up characters who barely register in the film, but to suffuse the story with music making. All 13 actors play instruments, some more than one, and all are on stage for the entire show. It's kind of a big Irish hootenanny, set in a working bar. The audience can buy a pint before the show and during intermission. And songs are used in an unconventional way to tell the story. Director John Tiffany calls Once a song sung in a pub.
Well, it's a play about music. It's a piece of theatre about the healing power of music. And we don't really ever have that moment where somebody, supposedly in a realistic, naturalistic setting, suddenly bursts into song, because as the audience come in, everybody's singing. So that's the vocabulary, that's the world that we're in.
Steve Kazzy plays the role Glenn Hansard played in the film, known only as The Guy. He says having the cast on stage accompanying the songs is a powerful experience.
I don't know, it's a really beautiful thing to be a part of, to sort of be on stage and be wrapped up inside of that swell of like an ensemble full of musicians and singers.
Take this sinking boat.
Kazzy says the musical has more dramatic thrust than the film, which he loves.
In the film, it's more about two people who meet, they fall in love, and they have this thing for a week. In our show, it's about a guy who's broken, really broken, and a girl who's broken, and find a way to heal themselves through each other.
Kristen Milioti plays the girl. She says the moment where the two characters really connect is in a music shop where they sing Falling Slowly.
Like when you first meet someone and you know something's there, but you're both like learning each other's language, and then you find out we can both speak music, and that's like when it takes off.
Raise your hopeful voice. You have the choice.
Enda Walsh says for him, the girl's character is the heart of the show. She's the one who pushes the guy and the other characters to pursue their musical dreams.
Her character sort of barely existed on screen, but for me was all about the light, was all about someone who could change your world and change your life immediately. And yet, this sort of maelstrom of sort of emotion that goes on with her, you don't know actually what is all of her story.
When I can't really causes only silence. I think of your smile with pride in your eyes, a lover that sighs.
Walsh says when he was called for this project, he had never even seen the movie.
I watched it and I thought, all right, this is It's a Wonderful Life, effectively. It's sort of, you know, the story of a guy who's sort of given up on stuff, and this sort of angel arrives in and casts a light over his life somehow and the people around him.
Once opens tonight at the New York Theatre Workshop off Broadway. If all goes well, it could follow another show which started on the very same stage, Rent, to Broadway. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
If you ever want something and you call, then I'll come right.
The presidents of private universities appear to be doing very well. That's according to a new study by the Chronicle of Higher Education. It found 36 university presidents who earned more than $1 million. That was compensation in the year 2009. And the gap between pay for private university presidents and professors is increasing. Jack Stripling co-wrote that story in the Chronicle, where he's a senior reporter, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And this is something the Chronicle reports on annually. So what's changed in numbers for 2009 from numbers in 2008 for university president pay?
Well, this year we found the median total compensation for presidents of private nonprofit institutions was just under $306,000. The increase in terms of a percentage change is rather slight. It's about 2% up from what we recorded last year. We do have 36 presidents making more than $1 million this year as opposed to 33 the year before.
Well, who wins the competition as the highest paid private university president, or at least in 2009?
I don't know if I would define it as winning, but it's $4.9 million that Constantine Papadakis collected. But he was the president of Drexel University and is now deceased. A big part of the compensation that was recorded this year for him was attributed to a life insurance policy payout for his wife.
To his wife. So who would be the highest paid university president who remained in place?
That would be Nicholas Zepos, who's the president of Vanderbilt University. He collected just under $1.9 million for the 2009 calendar year.
And there's another measure you use, you say, which is this year you also compared university presidents' pay to the pay of professors at their on their campuses. What did you find?
Well, we found that by and large, most presidents make about 3.5 times that of full professors on their campus. At the same time, we found 6 institutions where presidents made more than 10 times that of professors on their campus. The biggest disparity was at Stevenson University in Maryland, where Kevin Manning made 16 times that of professors on his campus. A big part of that was a deferred compensation payout that he received in 2009. But at the same time, even if you looked at him in the year prior, he still made 7 times that of professors on his campus, which was considerably greater than the median.
What did universities tell you when somebody at least answered your questions in defense of pretty high compensation packages?
As you would expect, universities and particularly the boards of trustees that set these compensation levels are wanting to reward what they perceive as great performance. And a lot of cases, the deferred compensation packages come in later in one's career to reward years of service.
And in fairness, the president of a university, unlike the professors, is deeply engaged in raising money for the universities. Part of his job is making money for the institution.
That's right.
Is this a contentious issue on campuses, or do people pretty much accept it?
As you would imagine, any time there is a period of economic difficulty, compensation for executives comes under fire in higher education, just like any other area of the country. And so we've seen at the University of Pennsylvania, for instance, Amy Guttman, one of the higher paid presidents, has been targeted by students on that campus who are members of an offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street movement. I think we'll see more of that as these data start to become public. Students who are frustrated with tuition rising and other economic problems will look at their presidents and question the level of pay.
Although in the case of Amy Guttman, her pay as a share of the University of Pennsylvania's budget would not be nearly so great as a million-dollar package for someone at a very small college.
That's right. That's right. Now, relative to budget, presidents who make the smallest amount tend to come from the wealthiest institutions, but you can do the math.
Well, Jack Stripling, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Stripling is a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's co-author of an analysis of what university presidents at private universities are paid.
Now, while U.S. delegates at the Durban conference think a new climate treaty is premature, one American state is going ahead on its own. California is set to limit climate warming gases starting in 2013. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, the state's argument is that it's good for the economy.
California's climate law, known as AB 32, is a big step at a time when the state's economy is shaky. It puts a statewide cap on the amount of greenhouse gases coming out of smokestacks and tailpipes. At a hearing recently in Sacramento, skeptics gave state regulators an earful. Among them was single mother Kathy West.
I'm a maintenance mechanic at the ConocoPhillips refinery. At our Santa Maria refinery, we just hired 12 operators and two mechanics. What's going to happen to their future, their families? What about your jobs when you get rid of the refining out of California?
There's no doubt this measure will make electricity and gas prices go up. How much is a matter of much debate. Some say thousands of dollars a year for businesses. The state says costs pale in light of new business the law will create. Mary Nichols runs the Air Resources Board, which administers the law. She says capping emissions forces companies to adapt.
Putting that cap on top of that whole system would be the best way to unleash the power of private capital to really get the most out of not just research and development, but actual deployment of green technologies.
My name is Matt Horton. I'm the CEO of Propel Fuels.
Propel Fuels is the kind of green technology that Nichols is talking about. The company installs seals, gaskets, hoses, underground tanks, and pumps that can handle biofuels. Companion laws to AB 32 will require more of them, and they're already being dispensed at gas stations like this one near San Francisco.
We did start out in Seattle as a company. We did move down here to California because it's a great market, a lot more vehicles, a lot more consumers that are interested in renewable fuels.
Horton says the climate laws create business.
We would not be here in the state if it weren't for the favorable policies that the state government had enacted.
Propel will open its 27th station this year. Most are in California. Customers like Sean Leong say, bring it on. Leong owns a 1984 Mercedes that can run on straight biodiesel, like the recycled vegetable oil pumped at this station.
It's my lifestyle I choose. I own a florist, and, you know, we don't create pollution. We try not to. My home has solar panels on it.
In fact, Leong is disappointed that the station here only pumps fuel with 5% biodiesel. He prefers the pure stuff. Some drivers are looking beyond the environmental benefits. Student Andre Savastru has modified his car to run on 85% ethanol, which is also sold at this station.
You get a great deal of difference in performance. Personally, I've got about 40 to 50 horsepower more.
The biggest reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, however, will have to come from refineries and power plants. Each company will get allowances to emit a certain amount. If they can't live within the cap, they can pay someone else to reduce gases somewhere else. And that means business for a company called Jayco Environmental. Just outside San Francisco, hundreds of cast-off refrigerators are scattered across the floor of a warehouse. Michael Dunham cuts into one with a power saw. He calls it filleting the fridge. The local electric utility pays people $35 each for these old, inefficient appliances. They're a drain on the electricity grid. They're brought here to refrigerator purgatory, where Jayco takes over. Dunham pries apart the fridge with a shovel.
The most interesting thing we ever found was a rattlesnake.
What Dunham's after is the 10 pounds of foam that's inside the walls of the fridge.
And embedded in that 10 pounds is 1 pound of CFC-11 gas.
CFC-11 is a chlorofluorocarbon, a form of freon and a very powerful greenhouse gas, the kind that warms the planet. There are other CFCs in the fridge's compressor as well.
It will all go up into the atmosphere if it's not taken care of. So what we do is we capture it.
Jayco removes the foam and other CFCs in the refrigerator's compressor and sends it out to be destroyed. California's climate law sets up a system to verify that the CFCs are destroyed. Each pound that's eliminated creates a credit. A company called EOS Climate buys those credits and then sells them to California companies that need to reduce their carbon footprint. Jeff Cohen, vice president of EOS, says CFCs are a climate time bomb buried inside old refrigerators.
So what we did was create a financial incentive to pull this stuff out, to address the remaining banks of CFCs, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
So what regulators in California are doing is turning greenhouse gases into a commodity. You can make money by getting rid of that commodity, whether it's CFCs or methane or carbon dioxide. The experiment officially begins January 1st, 2013. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Part of California's experiment could involve what's called carbon ranching. We'll hear about that tomorrow.
The United States Postal Service is proposing drastic cuts and a slowdown of its service to try to save money. The mail service is billions of dollars in the red. It's been losing money as mail consumers turn to the Internet. But the USPS also faces growing competition from other companies, and it's not just FedEx and UPS. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The proposed cuts would make snail mail a little slower. Overnight first-class delivery would become a thing of the past, arriving on average a day later. The savings would come from cutting more than half the Postal Service's mail processing centers, and it would cut 28,000 employees. That's out of more than 500,000 workers. At a news conference, Post Office Vice President David Williams was straightforward in his assessment.
The fact of the matter is, our network is too big. We've got more capacity in our network than we can afford.
Services like FedEx and UPS dominate the guaranteed mail market. Email and online bill pay, meanwhile, eat away at the post office's core business. 10 years ago, it handled 104 billion pieces of first-class mail. Last year, it was 30% below that, and there's nothing staunching that flow. When questioned about the post office's competitiveness in a marketplace that values speed, Williams offered no defense.
They're already choosing speed. They're choosing electronic bill payment. They're choosing electronic communication via the Internet and email, things like that. That's what's driving this reason for doing what we've got to do.
But the Postal Service is also limited in its ability to adapt. It's a quasi-governmental agency whose rates are set by Congress. Keith Schoonmaker is an analyst with the research firm Morningstar. He says UPS and FedEx could potentially benefit if Postal Service is slower. Those companies are expanding internationally and delivering more packages, even as the post office shrinks.
The Postal Service is somewhat at the mercy of Congress in that it has a formal mandate to execute first-class delivery reliably, and yet it can't set market prices.
Also, much of what it delivers, few consumers want.
I had an epiphany one day when I went to my mailbox and it was shoved full of junk mail, and there's only two or three important things I needed in all of this 3 or 4 pounds of paper.
That is Steve Shiver, whose epiphany led him to found Doxo, a young company that helps consumers manage their bills and other documents online. As a consumer, Shiver says, he's come to think of his postman as the guy who delivers advertising.
I generally want my government services focused on things that are really both efficient and valuable for me as a citizen. And what's unfortunately happened incrementally over the years is a greater and greater proportion of physical mail is junk.
Back in Washington at the Postal Service's press conference, its executives acknowledged it's increasingly reliant on direct mail advertising for revenue. Appearing at the end of the press conference, U.S. Postmaster General Patrick Donahue made his pitch to send something of perhaps more value.
Remember, mail plenty of holiday cards. We could certainly use them. Thank you.
The earliest the changes could take effect is April of next year. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Today, activists across the country are calling for people to demonstrate at banks and bank-owned foreclosed homes. This day of action is being promoted by a spin-off of the Occupy Wall Street movement. The goal here is to stop foreclosures while also housing homeless people in properties that are vacant. Latoya Dennis, a member station WUWM, reports on a Madison, Wisconsin group that's already in action.
Just down the road from the state capitol building in Madison, Christina Long is living in a three-bedroom duplex.
This is the kitchen. It's nice and neat. Stove, table, refrigerator, dishwasher.
Long has lived here for the past 3 months. She's furnished the living room with a couch, a console TV set that looks like it's from the 70s, and a storage cabinet. She says there's nothing like having your own home, but there's just one catch. It's not her home, and she's not renting it either.
It's illegal, but at the same time, it's reasonable to me. I mean, you know, is it really illegal to have somewhere to stay? To me, sociably, no, it's fair.
Long is a single mother of three from Chicago, and she argues that housing should be a human right.
Everyone deserves somewhere to live. Everyone deserves their own peace of mind. Everybody deserves to be comfortable.
Long moved into this duplex with the help of a national group called Take Back the Land that has a branch here in Madison. Its goal is to move homeless people into bank or government-owned foreclosures and help those about to lose their homes stay in them. Since last May, the Madison group has occupied four properties, though right now it only has this one duplex. Max Rameau founded Take Back the Land 5 years ago and is one of those calling for civil disobedience at banks and foreclosed homes across the country today.
The companies who are responsible for kicking people out of their home have already gotten hundreds of millions of dollars of bailout money from the very people who they kicked out of those homes. So we've financed our own evictions in a real significant way.
Rameau isn't sure how many people will participate in protests, but he hopes it's only the beginning.
December 6th is and will be seen as the practice round for what we're calling the 2012 Spring Offensive, where you're going to see the occupation and liberation of homes all across the United States.
If that happens, Clayton Patton says it will present a new problem. Patton is a real estate agent at Encompass Realty Group in Milwaukee.
You can't sell it if you can't show the property to a prospective buyer.
Patton says typically, while homes that are lived in are in much better shape than those that sit vacant, that's just not the case when squatters are involved.
When tenants, or we can call them squatters in this particular case, stay in the home, the house starts to become in a deteriorated state because no one's keeping up on the major minor repairs on the house.
Banks aren't happy about squatters either. Those contacted for this story declined to be interviewed, though Chase Bank did say it has encountered squatters in some of its foreclosed homes. A Chase spokeswoman says when it does, the bank works with local police to evict them. For NPR News, I'm Latoya Dennis in Milwaukee.
Now, some news from outside our solar system. Scientists have discovered a planet that shares key characteristics with Earth. It circles a distant star that is much like our sun, and this planet is in the so-called Goldilocks zone around that star, not too hot and not too cold. As we hear from NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce, it is the sort of planet that could be home to liquid water and possibly to life.
In 2009, NASA launched the Kepler Space Telescope on a mission to find other Earths outside our solar system. To find them, the telescope has stared at over 100,000 stars in one patch of sky, watching and waiting for a slight dimming. That telltale dimming happens when an orbiting planet passes in front of a star, partially obscuring its light. Today, at a press briefing, researchers announced Kepler's latest discoveries, including one planet that shares key features with our home.
Today, I have the privilege of announcing the discovery of
Kepler's first planet, an habitable zone of a sun-like star.
NASA's William Borucki is the head of the Kepler mission. He says the new planet is called Kepler-22b. It's about 2.5 times the size of the Earth. It's a little closer to its star than our planet is to our sun. Kepler-22b goes around once every 290 days, compared to our 365, but its star is a bit cooler than our sun.
That means that that planet has a rather similar temperature to that of the Earth.
Borucki says it's not yet clear what kind of surface the planet might have. Researchers don't know if it's made mostly of rock or water or what, but at least temperature-wise, it would be very pleasant.
Its surface temperature would be something like 72 Fahrenheit.
Still, don't expect astronauts to climb on a rocket and go there anytime soon.
The star is some 600 light years away, so it's not terribly far away, but not terribly close either.
Over the last decade or so, scientists have confirmed the presence of hundreds of planets around distant stars, but they're mostly gas giants, small worlds that could potentially have a rocky surface and maybe even alien life crawling around have been much harder to find. Kepler-22b is the first one to be found smack dab in the middle of the habitable zone of a star like our own. But there's hints of more to come. Scientists are looking at 5 in particular of the more than 2,000 different-sized planets Kepler has detected that need to be confirmed. Natalie Battaglia is a researcher on the Kepler team.
We believe that we've got some very, very viable candidates here that are Earth-sized, near Earth-sized, and in the habitable zone.
Just being in the habitable zone, of course, does not mean a planet is actually habitable. Mark Kushner is an astrophysicist at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He says the habitable zone has been a useful concept for thinking about planets in the past, but
I think it may be time to discard the habitable zone. I think maybe what this discovery is telling us is it's time to move past it and start asking the next question, which is the planet moist and juicy like our own planet Earth?
He says scientists are already working on powerful instruments that could someday detect signs of water on one of these alien worlds. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.